I'm definitely not one of those people who says it's, you know, money's just this neutral energy and it's our beliefs about money that are the problem, because it's not a neutral energy. It actually has certain dynamics built into it. For example, it has scarcity built into it. There's never enough of it, and that's a systemic necessity, the way that it is today. So even if everybody had abundant attitudes about money, there still wouldn't be enough of it. It would be like you know, giving 10 hungry people not quite enough food and telling them just to think abundantly. Like, there's not enough food, and if you're the one who's cutting off their supply of food, you're actually being quite hypocritical by telling them to think abundantly. I mean, why not just give them more food?
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. Today I will be interviewing an acclaimed author from the US. Charles Eisenstein is a public speaker and a self-described degrowth activist. He was born in 1967 and was a very sensitive intellectual and dreamy child, always consumed by questions like, where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? He graduated from Yale University with a degree in mathematics and philosophy, but the development of reason and intellect brought him no closer to any truth that he really cared about. In his late 20s, Charles entered a long period of searching and personal exploration. From there, he has written four books, The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, and The More Beautiful World Our Heart Knows Is Possible. Oh, and The Yoga of Eating. Good morning, Charles, or good evening to you in the States. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I first heard of you when I came across your book, Sacred Economics, and I bought a copy. And very interestingly, I lent it to a friend recently, and I really didn't want to lend it, you know. I wanted to keep it, and I should have done, because, of course, now I'm doing the interview with you. But anyway, I wonder if you could tell me, what do you mean by the title Sacred Economics?
In a way, sometimes I regret that title, because I joke that half the people won't read it because it has the word sacred in it, and the other half won't read it because it has economics in it. People don't usually, you know, people who are think in terms of the sacred usually aren't necessarily interested in economics, and people who are interested in the nitty-gritty of money and economy and stuff don't identify with somebody, you know, with caring about the sacred. So it's kind of, but the book does kind of try to bridge those two worlds.
That is what I'm very interested in doing myself, Charles, and the title was what attracted me. So it worked for some people.
Well, at least one person. But, yeah, so it's basically about, why is money and economy in the world today anything but sacred? You know, why does it seem that when you ask what's the reason for all the horrible things happening, that the answer is usually something to do with money? Like, why is that? And what would it look like for money or human exchange and cooperation to be in service of the things that we are coming to hold sacred? Like, how would money have to change? So that's kind of what the book's about. Like, why it is the way it is and how it can be different.
So you're not saying, because money in itself is sort of inert, is it our attitude to our money or the monetary system that requires changing?
Both, actually, because the system reflects our attitudes, and our attitudes are a product of the system. So I'm definitely not one of those people who says it's, you know, money's just this neutral energy and it's our beliefs about money that are the problem, because it's not a neutral energy. It actually has certain dynamics built into it. For example, it has scarcity built into it. There's never enough of it, and that's a systemic necessity, the way that it is today. So even if everybody had abundant attitudes about money, there still wouldn't be enough of it. It would be like you know, giving 10 hungry people not quite enough food and telling them just to think abundantly. Like, there's not enough food, and if you're the one who's cutting off their supply of food, you're actually being quite hypocritical by telling them to think abundantly. I mean, why not just give them more food? And so the same thing is kind of true of the money system. You know, we could have a money system that's not fundamentally built on scarcity.
Would you then be talking to some degree about the banking system and the system of charging interest?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. The system by which our money is created in the first place, it's lent into existence by banks and other institutions. So the money that's created through the act of lending is accompanied by a debt that is more than the amount that was created, because it was an interest-bearing loan. So there's always more debt than there is money, which means to avoid bankruptcies, you have to continue creating more and more and more money to pay back the debts that were created by the original money. And so the system, so it's the second thing. Besides this kind of omnipresent scarcity, it also creates an imperative for endless growth. And as long as more and more money is being created, then the system kind of works. As long as there's a constant growth of the economy, because you can't sustainably keep creating more and more money unless the economy of goods and services is growing as well. So as long as that's happening, we're fine. As long as there's still more oil to drill out of the ground, forests to cut down, oceans to turn into a fish harvest, and so on. As long as we still have some of those things, and also human relationships to convert into services, things that we didn't pay for becoming services, like childcare or music or things like that. So as long as there's some of that left, then the economy can keep growing, the money system still works. But in the world today, we're reaching ecological and social limits to the expansion of the economy. And maybe also you could say, like, spiritual limits or psychic limits, because there's a kind of impoverishment of life when everything is converted into money. So anyway, that's the crisis. The end of growth causing an unraveling of the money system and a transition then into something else.
Right. Well, I described you at the beginning as you were, had described yourself as a degrowth activist, because we can't keep growing, can we? And would you say that growth that we're basing our whole way of life on, is that the underlying cause of the current economic difficulties?
Why is everybody calling me a degrowth activist? Where is that coming from?
Off your website.
Ah, interesting. I think, I don't know how, yeah, because I mean, occasionally I describe myself that way, but it's really, I mean, I don't really identify with that. But anyway, I mean, I do think degrowth is a necessity from where we are right now, because what growth means is more and more of the non-monetized realm entering the monetized realm. So, for example, if you have a village where everybody takes care of each other's children and makes music and entertainment and knows how to build their own houses, and if your house burns down, everybody comes together and rebuilds it for you, that has a very low rate of monetized economic activity. But if you then come in and everyone starts sending their kids to daycare centers and school, and has to pay people to build their houses and buys music from record companies and buys insurance so that if their house burns down, they can pay for a new house and their neighbors don't have to help them. Like, that conversion is economic growth. The realm of services, paid services, has grown. But it's hard to say if these people are actually better off because they pay strangers or professionals to do the things they once did for each other. It's hard to say that they're actually better off. And so that's kind of, and in fact, you could say that they're worse off because now everyone's well-being and security and happiness depends on money, whereas before it depended on community. So, yeah, that's one aspect of the problem of growth.
I think many of our listeners will understand the importance of community. However, actually creating them is quite another question, because everything in the system really works against it. I mean, it would be wonderful if new housing was built, around some sort of square, and people mm-hmm. could all contribute. But it doesn't work like this, sadly. And so I think that it's going to be quite difficult to make a change, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's change, though, that's happening on many levels. Like, there are a lot of the new generation of urban planners and architects and city designers are understanding the need to build at least the support for community and the support for public life into the infrastructure. Like, that's an understanding that's happening, and we're no longer venerating the separate single-family home with its own lawn as the pinnacle of human development, you know? So there is an awakening happening there that enables community to thrive. But still, when you try to enter a community with people, then money issues usually come up because we're very conditioned and economically pressured to look out for ourselves and to maximize our self-interest. So as long as everybody's getting along fine, it's okay. But then when trouble starts and money issues come up, people having had no experience or traditions of communal conflict resolution, everybody just goes to the courts, goes to the legal system, which is based on separate individuals owning property, and that's kind of the default. So there's, a infrastructural component, there's a legal component, and of course there's the nature of money itself. That I'm not saying competition is absent otherwise, but it creates this kind of ambient pressure toward competition as a default. So all of these things make it hard to restore community, but we're still doing it and learning.
Right. Well, in Auckland, New Zealand here, we don't have very much space. We're running out of space as a city without chopping down all our nice native bush around the edge. And so, we're jamming in houses where possible. And I think we're the fourth most expensive city to live in the world, I think. Wow. Just a very basic house costs over $500,000 in, one of the less salubrious suburbs. So we've got big problems here with that. So establishing community isn't going to happen within a city. You'd have to go outside a city here. But the whole thing is, really, the difficulties with community is that we've been conditioned to individualism, haven't we?
Yeah. I think, though, that even in a place like Auckland, you could have community, theoretically. I'm thinking of cities from the early part of the 20th century where there were these ethnic neighborhoods in the U.S. at least, where there was, you know, whole neighborhoods of Polish people or Italian people or Irish or Jews, and everybody knew each other on your block, on your street, in your tenement, and your cousins, your brothers, you know, your uncles would live within walking distance, and every face that you saw was someone you knew, or someone who you kind of knew someone who knew that person. Like, there was a social matrix that tied everybody together. So that's a kind of community that we don't have so much today when people are highly mobile. And one reason they're highly mobile is because of the globalization of the economy and the dissociation of work and of life from place. So it's not just, you know, I don't think that in principle that you have to, you know, go off into the countryside and have an eco-village. I mean, that's certainly a worthy thing to do, and there's good reason to do that. But ultimately, not everybody is going to be able to do that. And we also have to transform the places that we already live.
Right. So we're very, in Auckland here, very mobile because the public transport system is bad anyway. But I think we tend to get together in groups that involve going places in cars a lot. For example, I've got some people coming over for meditation evenings on a Monday night, and they all need to come in a vehicle of some description because, A, they're coming from some distance, and B, there's no public public transport anywhere close.
Yeah. Mm.
So it does make it difficult. So we have got challenges, but what are some of the hopeful trends you see?
Well, one hopeful trend globally, and this is maybe kind of a darkly hopeful trend, is that the current system isn't working very well and shows signs of a collapse. I don't know when the collapse will happen, but I think whether in personal life or in the life of a civilization, really big changes don't happen without some kind of breakdown, some kind of crisis that makes it plain to everybody that normal is over, and that plunges the person or the society into a time of unknowing, of uncertainty. I call it a space between stories, where the old answers to how to live life, how to run a society, the old normal is gone, and the new one isn't there yet, and so your whole operating system no longer works. And in that time, you know, there's lots of wonderful ideas about how to structure an economy. You know, what kind of money? I mean, I wrote a lot about this in Sacred Economics. What would a money system look like that is the ally of ecology and not the enemy of it? The ally of social justice and not the enemy of it. What would that look like? And these ideas, there's many, not just for me, you know, there's many ideas like that out there, but they're all marginal because the mainstream, the center, the establishment is still standing. But when that disintegrates, then the things that had seemed like these hopelessly idealistic concepts become thinkable. They maybe even become common sense because the center has broken down, and so the things on the margins can come in. So that, for me, that's reason for hope, that this transition time of crisis, breakdown, space between, and then something new emerging is getting close. I'm not sure if that makes you feel hopeful, but...
Well, it's exactly how I see it, because I've initiated a political movement which we hope will be a political party called the Awareness Party. And I suppose your title, Sacred Economics, the title of your book, is how I guess we see things, that we need a political party that understands the integrated living system, the Gaia principle, and of consciousness, and of all the other things that are not represented in the material political system at the moment. So, and I think, I like you, that when society does start to break down because the monetary system or something else around trade falls over, that is the time that people will start to look around and say, hey, we've got some new ideas here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think bringing in the bigger picture, the quantum physics, for people to understand is part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the money system that we have now kind of makes sense embedded in the deeper stories that really run our society. And one of those stories is, you could call it the mechanical universe, the idea that nature is a bunch of random forces and particles, generic particles bouncing around out there, and lacking any livingness or intelligence or consciousness of their own. It's just, you know, a bunch of stuff out there, and that therefore the role of humanity is to impose intelligence, to impose order, to put these building blocks together in the shape that serves us best. That's what I call the old story, or part of the old story. And our economic system fits in completely. It's perfectly into that old story because it treats the world as commodities and values them only for their utility, for their use to us. So this transition that you're talking about in, you know, use the word quantum, and it is kind of a transition away from a Newtonian mindset, but this transition toward understanding that we're part of a living planet and a living universe, and that all things have the qualities of self that we've assumed belong to humans alone, that all things have they're worthy of respect, but all things have some kind of intelligence or sacredness. When we understand that, then the current economic system doesn't really make sense anymore. And so we ask, what kind of economic system would be aligned with respect and understanding for the interconnected, interexistent nature of all beings? Like, what would that look like? So, yeah, it's these things, this transition, you know, the economic dimension, the political dimension, the spiritual dimension, if you want to call it that, all of these things are part of the same larger movement, the transition in our mythology. The mythology, the deep stories that say who you are, why you're here, what a human being is, what's real, what's valuable, how change happens, what a self is. These stories are changing.
Yes, they are indeed. And I think the old ones were to some degree based on Genesis, you know, where it says that man was given dominion over nature, basically. And it's been that, rather than seeing us in the indigenous way of things, of tending the garden. And so that's been possibly the basis of our mistake, the mythology that we have taken on. So what would you say was your vision for a new economy?
Well, you know, in the book I wrote, I mean, there's a couple ways I could answer that. In the book, I wrote some of the nuts and bolts of what it might look like, with, you know, things like negative interest economics and universal basic income, and there's various concrete things like that I explore in quite a lot of depth. That's the part that an economist might be interested in.
I think the listeners would be very interested in a universal basic income, because it's become quite a conversation now.
Yeah, that's another sign for hope. Like, some of these things that I wrote about that were really obscure back then. I mean, I wrote the book, I did the writing in 2009, 2010, you know. came out in 2011. So, like, a lot of these things I wrote about were pretty obscure then, and now they've become more and more prominent. I can't take credit for that, but it feels like there's a trend toward these things that I was describing. But yeah, that's the other aspect I was going to mention is a transition toward the spirit of gift, which underlies all of the systems level policies that I wrote about. And by gift, it's essentially seeing human nature instead of being driven to maximize self-interest, to see our nature as beings of gift that have been given everything we need, given our very lives, receiving this earth, air, water, sunlight. None of that did we earn through our hard efforts. And so being so immensely gifted, we feel gratitude, which is the desire to give in turn. And we have capacities through which we can give in turn. And so that, I'm basically saying that is a fundamental part of human nature that has been overlooked in current economic theory. But anybody, I challenge anybody to achieve complete financial security and based on that alone to be happy with life. If you're not doing something that calls forth your gifts towards something meaningful to you, you're not going to feel satisfied. And you're going to maybe chase more and more and more money or possessions or status or something like that to compensate for the poverty of meaning in your life. But no amount will be enough, you know. And then you find something that is meaningful to you, that does engage your gifts. And then, like, the chase for money and status goes away because the real need's being met. So one way to look at sacred economy is to say, what would an economy look like that's based on the principle of gift?
I think that's a wonderful solution. It's going to take a little change of mindset to get that going right through. But as you say, it only takes a crisis, people might just get that. And so would you relate a universal basic income to gift?
Mm-hmm.
Because in New Zealand, we have a universal basic income for those people over 65. The pension. And it's the same amount, and it's not means tested here. If you have some other income, you pay secondary tax on either that other income or the pension, whichever is larger, which is good. But why not have a universal basic income for everyone?
So it is kind of infused with the spirit of the gift. I mean, for one thing, the standard objection to it is that if no one had to work to earn money to live, then no one would work. But really what that saying is, that is basically saying, Lisa, I know you. If you could, you would just sit around in front of the telly eating chocolate bonbons and doing nothing all day. But fortunately, we have this money pressure that forces you to go out and be a productive member of society. It's a really sour view of human nature.
I'm laughing here because I'm retired and I've started a political party and I do radio interviews and I'm as busy as when I was working.
it's not because you're suffering financial stress and are forced to do this work, is it?
No.
And this is empirically borne out. You know, when people have their basic needs met, then actually they can turn their time and energy and creativity toward doing the things that actually really need to be done in this world. I mean, so much right now of what people are paid to do isn't what the planet is most thirsty for. And the things that really need to be done right now, there's not a lot of money in that, you know? So a universal basic income would free up creativity and energy and time to go toward the things that people really care about. And if you wanted to, if you wanted people to work for you, you would have to create jobs that people want to do, even if they're not paid to do it. They're going to have to be fulfilling, meaningful, interesting. You'd have to engineer that into your industrial design, in fact. So it's that's one way that it resonates with the spirit of gift. And another thing, too, is that, like, one of the justifications for it or arguments for it is that right now humanity is sitting upon a tremendous pile of wealth, not only the wealth of nature, which none of us created, but also the wealth of cultural invention going back thousands of years. The inventions of, you know, James Watt, you know, and Thomas Edison, and whoever else you want to name. Like, is any one person alive more deserving of the benefits of this natural and cultural heritage than another person is? No. We're all equally, we all should have an equal right and equal share of this inheritance. And so universal basic income reflects that.
Yes.
Now, of course, you can still work, you know, and make money. I mean, there are some people who want more than just the basics, and they want to, you know, buy a yacht or whatever. Like, you know, it's not that people would stop working or stop being motivated by money, but there wouldn't be this constant anxiety underlying all of life that leaves you never free from fear, no matter how much you have, because, you know, what if your investments go bad? What if the stock market crashes? There wouldn't be that constant ambient anxiety anymore. And you wouldn't be able to force people to do things based on survival anxiety.
Well, I think that most people want to make some sort of contribution. So if jobs are looked upon as you're making a contribution to society, then it changes the attitude towards work from the Puritan work ethic, where you have to work and you have to support yourself, to I'm making a contribution to the society in which I live.
Right.
Would you agree?
Just that simple.
Mm. Yeah. So a lot of the things here are really actually mindset changes, aren't they?
Yeah, or at least, you know, you can't just change the mindset without changing the system, because they both go hand in hand. Like, many of us, me, you, probably a lot of people listening, have had these glimpses into, oh, yeah, you know, this is really my true nature. I just want to give. I just want to be of service. And it's so clear. But then in the context of our current system, it's really scary to act on that. And if you do act on that, sometimes things don't work out for you. You know, you can't find a job maybe doing something you really love. I don't think that it's, I think that there's, that the system kind of creates the mindset just as much as the mindset creates the system. We're not these separate individuals who can exercise full sovereignty over our thoughts and beliefs. That's a New Age dogma that I think actually on a subtle level buys into the same separation that is at the root of our whole system. I mean, that's what the old story is. It's the story of separation. But we're not actually separate beings. We are inter-beings, interrelated, interconnected, interexistent. So there's a limit to how much you can change your own attitudes through an act of will in an environment that encourages the opposite attitude and gives constant pressure to conform. And that's why this like kind of personal psychological transformation has to accompany systems level activism or efforts to make change.
Oh, I so agree with you. It's so nice to hear that. So really, it's our collective consciousness that is holding us back but can be the key to the future, would you say? Because then the 100th monkey or morphic resonance happens, and suddenly everybody gets it?
Yeah, you could say that. Changing collective consciousness through not only personal work, but also through our relationships, through our interface with the collective, through our actions in the world. Yeah.
So you've mentioned that. You've mentioned the gift economy. What other keys do you have for transitioning to sacred economics? Or are they the core underlying, and of course, crisis?
Well, let me say, I don't really know how to transition into a sacred economy. I have some ideas about what the transition might look like. I have a proposal that would be, I think, really practical in the event of another financial meltdown. I have an idea for how we could maybe hasten that day.
Can you tell us about those?
Well, I think that the crux of it all, obviously, is debt. And interestingly, that's the one thing that has become purely data. It's the one form of activism or resistance that doesn't require going out into the streets, that doesn't, today a lot of activism has become a matter of people typing on their computers, whatever, online petitions or spreading stories, spreading information and so on and so forth. And a lot of people here are kind of frustrated with that, feeling it's very ineffective. But the one thing that would be extremely effective, and that requires, that it's really only about information, is money. So, practically speaking, there could be a debt strike, for example, a boycott on making payments on debt, servicing your credit card, mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. And it wouldn't take that large a percentage of people to do that for the entire system just to completely collapse. So there's a kind of people power that could be expressed that way at some point. And it's one of those things that if you are the only one doing it, then you just get squashed. You lose your house or whatever. But if a significant movement of people do it, then they can't take everybody's house. They can't put everybody in jail, So I think that might be, at some point, a really effective expression of people power. But I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. I've refused to have debt apart from a mortgage from all of my life. So I have not bought things on hire purchase and things like that. I've just refused to give that extra money to companies. But now, when my sons started university, they were immediately given credit cards and told that they could have $1,000 debt. It's so built into the system. And I had, before that, got my sons convinced that my way was a better way. But then, the temptation of that $1,000 debt on a credit card to a young fellow is very strong.
Right. And also, I'm not sure how it is in New Zealand, but here, the kind of lifestyle that you could once live without going into debt now is impossible on a median income. It used to be 50 years ago that with a high school education, a single wage earner could support a family and buy a house. And now that's almost impossible even for two wage earners. And people cannot live the kind of lives, the kind of standard of living that their parents did on the kind of jobs that are readily available. So in order to maintain that standard, they go into debt.
Well, it's similar here, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of built in to the way things are. And obviously, it's unsustainable. But it can be sustained as long as there's still some wealth in the middle classes to hollow out and to transfer to the creditor classes. And when there's none left, when people get miserable enough and they either can't or refuse to continue servicing their loans, then the system collapses.
So I'm very
interested. There's a lot of misery between...
Oh, there will be, and the poorer the people, the worse the misery. This is the concern that I have about doing anything to assist collapsing the system.
Yes.
Is there any other way that we could assist the process, though, without...
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so there's the old story falling apart, and then there's also, and pushing us out of where we've been, and there's also a new story that's emerging that pulls us toward it. So anything that we do to weaken, to disrupt the old story, or to strengthen the new story will accelerate the transition. And because the old story is really a story of separation, of scarcity, of competition, of self-interest, any experience that we bring to people that violates those principles, that violates the principle of competition, of scarcity, of dog-eat-dog, anything that we do that doesn't fit into that experience of life is going to help the transition. So acts of generosity and kindness and compassion and love of any kind, that doesn't fit into the world that has been offered to us as normal. It's almost hard for people to believe when they witness real generosity, because, like, why would you do that, you know? Why aren't you, like, the whole environment tells us that human nature is to get the best deal. Human nature is to look out for yourself. When you go shopping, and there's two items that are identical, except the price is different, you pick the cheaper one, right?
Yes.
There you are. You're just out to get the best deal. Do you think, oh, you know, maybe I should buy the more expensive one because whoever's selling it deserves to make a good profit, and maybe the cheaper one, they're not paying their workers a living wage, and who knows what they're doing, so let me buy the more expensive one. People typically don't do that. That's not normal behavior. Normal behavior is you maximize the interest of yourself. And people take that then as a law of the universe, a law of human nature. And if you offer an exception to that rule, it suggests that, oh, maybe human nature isn't what we thought it was. Maybe the world built on that conception of human nature doesn't have to be this way. So it's a story disruptor. It can shake someone's reality if they witness a profound or receive a profound act of generosity. So this could be, you know, on a personal level or a social enterprise or anything that, because the old story seems like reality itself to those immersed in it. But it's not reality. It's just a story. It's just a story that says, here is what human nature is. Here is what the world is. And our whole civilization is built on that story. So if we can disrupt that story, then the systems built on it no longer are so solid. They're under doubt. They don't seem inevitable anymore.
Oh,
that's not too vague.
No, I don't see it as vague. And I see the possibility of it happening in the U.S. because of Donald Trump. And I suppose it depends on the way that people look at what's happening there as to whether they sort of throw up their hands in horror and scream and stamp their feet, or whether they say, well, is he here to teach us something?
Yeah, he's definitely disrupting normal. You know, a lot of kind of political truisms, things that have been true my entire life, are now no longer true. Like, politics as normal is gone. And people are starting to wake up to that. And in a way, that's a good thing, because really the changes that we've needed are so far beyond anything that's ever proposed in serious politics. So basically the whole system has been frozen inside a very, very narrow range of possibility. And so by revealing the system as broken, Donald Trump is opening the door for much, much bigger political changes, the kind that we really need.
So by...
Not that he himself is in favor of the kind of political changes that we really need, but he's basically saying anything's possible.
Yes. And also, many of the things that he's doing are making people so mad that that will open the door to change as well.
Yeah. And I think that it could be quite ugly for a while, because there's the levels of hatred here, the levels of polarization and of dehumanization of the other side are just through the roof on both sides.
That's very sad, really, because it's people projecting their own fear, I would imagine. So I hope it doesn't divide America too badly.
I don't know what's going to happen. But it does feel very unstable. And in a way that hasn't been obvious for a long time, anything could happen. You know, things that had seemed that would have seemed fanciful a few years ago, such as maybe even the breakup of the country, no longer seem that fanciful. You know, like, anything could happen. Total government breakdown, a new government, a new constitution, that could happen. Civil war, that could happen. I don't know what's going to happen. But we are in new territory. And maybe we'll just kind of go back to normal after, you know, maybe Donald Trump will be impeached and removed from office, and then we have a vice president who's even worse, and then the next election things kind of go back to normal. But you know, like, the normal of you know, American imperialism and ecological degradation and so forth that has proceeded under both Democrats and Republicans, do we really want that normal to continue?
No, I certainly wouldn't have thought so. And we need something to shake us up here in New Zealand, because there's not a lot of difference in the left-wing and the right-wing parties here. As I always say, you know, they're still wings on the same bird.
Yeah.
What can we do in our communities to contribute to a new economy? Just a tough one.
Yeah. I'm just thinking what small nuggets I could offer. One thing that I think is really important is to create or restore systems of mutual aid that don't depend on money. So some neighborhoods, for example, have sharing things like tool libraries. So instead of everyone in the neighborhood having their own set of power tools, you have like one big tool shed and workshop where anyone from the neighborhood can go and use the tools, borrow them. And then there's maybe someone who takes care of them, and it's kind of a community thing. Or other kinds of, just any way that people in a place can meet each other's needs without money, needs for companionship, needs for entertainment, for recreation, for healing, for labor, to help each other out with things, even for food to some extent, community gardens and things like that. Like, all of these things restore some of what's been lost in the process of monetization and economic growth and create a kind of resiliency. So that would be one really concrete thing that is happening in many places already.
Yes, it is. Yes, and I think community gardens, I think, is quite a popular one here that certainly is helpful. There's still that Puritan ethic, work ethic, you know, that, you know, you should be really working for what you get. And until we can let that go, because, I mean, in the olden days you had people, for example, who might be a scribe, and they would get on with their writing or whatever they were doing. They didn't have to go out and actually grow their own vegetables or work hard in the fields. Mm-hmm. And the people who worked in the fields and did the growing, they would feed the people who did the writing. But we sort of have almost a work ethic where you have to be out and doing something, and that maybe writing or painting or making music doesn't quite have the ability to earn money that... you know, or the people aren't taken care of in the way they would have been a few hundred years ago.
Well, a work ethic is only necessary if you're not internally motivated to do the work that you're doing. So in a factory system, for example, or in any kind of system where the work is tedious or difficult or degrading, then you're going to need a work ethic to force people to do it. But if the majority of work isn't like that, then you don't really need a work ethic in the same way. That's just a comment about that. And also, like, I think there's also a kind of a community spirit that takes over when lots of people are engaged in productive work in service of others. It inspires you to do the same. If everyone around you is being generous, and including generous to you, then you know that it's okay to be generous, that no matter how much you give to others, you'll be taken care of also, because you're part of a circle of gift. So to reestablish circles of gift, to reestablish ways that people's gifts can be shared and witnessed, that, like, I'm not saying that it will topple the existing economy, but it offers an alternative. It offers evidence that it doesn't have to be this way. So it weakens the feeling of inevitability of the current economic system and gives us kind of practice in doing it a different way.
Yes, I think that idea of practice is a very good one, actually. Thank you. Yes, putting those things into practice so that people see the difference would be very helpful. So, Charles, I'm just thinking about, since you wrote the book, have you had any significant thoughts that, continue on from what you wrote?
Well, I mean, I've not been writing too much on economics since then. I've turned to other topics.
Can you tell me about those? Or tell us about those?
Well, right now I'm writing about ecology, environment, climate change. I'm working on a book on that because it's a pretty important topic these days.
It is.
So, I'm not sure if we have enough time here for me to try to lay out the whole thesis.
We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'll just say one little piece that I've been realizing a lot as I do this research. It's that the contribution of intact ecosystems on even like a local level toward maintaining the health of the planet, the atmosphere, the climate, and so forth, the contribution of ecosystems, intact ecosystems, to that is much greater than anyone has really appreciated. And that, which is good news and bad news. The good news is that if we protect and restore ecosystems, then we can handle, the planet can handle the levels of CO2 that exist today. I mean, we still probably have to cut back on further emissions, but we'll be okay if we can protect and restore the kelp forests and the seagrass and the mangrove swamps and the rainforests and all the other ecosystems. The bad news is that if we don't do that, if we continue draining swamps and developing coastlines and cutting down forests, then even if we cut emissions to zero, the climate will still continue to spin out of control. One thing that I'm learning is that the focus of environmentalism more and more on carbon is a mistake. And we have to devote more attention than we've been devoting to preserving and protecting and restoring, regenerating ecosystems and making agriculture more ecological all over the globe, everywhere, which is actually more disruptive to business as usual than merely switching from fossil fuels to some other energy source.
Actually, that is, though, carbon, I can never say this word, sequestration, or however you say it.
Sequestration, yeah, that's part of it. Like, the intact ecosystems sequester way more carbon than we thought. But if you destroy them, then that sequestered carbon is released. So it's you know, not only that they don't sequester it anymore, but a lot of the carbon that they had sequestered gets released back into the atmosphere.
And this is happening in our agricultural systems, isn't it, as well as reducing trees and things?
Yes, right.
So that's an interesting concept, actually. Thank you very much for that one, because there's going to be somebody interviewed shortly on climate change, and they'll be coming into the studio shortly. So thank you for that. I shall pass that on. And you're writing about that and the ecosystems, and particularly in relation to climate. Any other areas?
I explore a lot of topics because this transition in our deep stories, our mythology, comes out in every way, you know. So I did an online course on masculinity, like the old story about how to be a man. Here's how you do it, Charles. Like, that doesn't work anymore. So does that mean we let go of gender identity completely, or is there a new kind of masculinity or an expression of masculinity that is aligned with what's beautiful to me? So that's one inquiry I've been working on, and I'm developing a course now on food and diet. I had written a book about that years and years ago, I've realized that that the war on nature, or the oppositionality to nature that our civilization has perpetrated, mirrors a war on the self, or an oppositionality to the self or to the body that uses the same tools of domination and control to try to improve ourselves, to improve our diets and so forth. So I'm applying it to that area. I like to, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of a generalist, which might be a more flattering way to say that I don't have any real deep expertise in anything.
Well, I think that actually that you see the bigger picture, because that's a deep thinker, because that's really how I see all that you've been saying. And they're all very important topics to talk about. In fact, I'd love to have another hour with you, but time is just about up. So thank you so much, Charles, for talking to me. I really, really enjoyed this, and I hope the listeners have too.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lisa. It's been my pleasure.
That was U.S. author Charles Eisenstein speaking with Lisa Eyre, and this interview is sponsored by The Awareness Party, www.theawarenessparty.com. You've been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week, 8 a.m. Thursdays, or anytime online at greenplanetfm.com.
Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, realize that what you think...